From it I know that you do not want to believe, you do not want to believe that anyone has an ability which you have not. You want to prove me wrong. No, he said, I do not want to prove you wrong. I want to prove that my own training, my own knowledge is right, and if you can see this aura then surely all that I have been taught is wrong. Not at all, I replied. I say that all your training goes to prove the existence of an aura, because from the very little that I have already studied of electricity in this college, it indicates to me that the human being is powered by electricity. What utter nonsense! He said. What absolute heresy! And he jumped to his feet. Come with me to the principal. We will get this thing settled. Dr. Li was sitting at his desk, busily engaged with the papers of the college. He looked up mildly as we entered, peering over the top of his glasses. Then he removed them to see us the more clearly. Reverend Principal, bawled the lecturer, this man, this fellow from Tibet says that he can see the aura and that we all have auras. He is trying to tell me that he knows more than I do. The professor of electricity and magnetism, Dr. Li, mildly motioned for us to be seated, and then said, well, what is it precisely? Lobsang Rampa can see auras. That I know. Of what do you complain? The lecturer absolutely gaped in astonishment. But, Reverend Principal, he exclaimed, do you believe in such nonsense, such heresy, such trickery? Most assuredly I do, said Dr. Li, for he comes of the highest in Tibet, and I have heard of him from the highest. Pochu looked really crestfallen. Dr. Li turned to me and said, Lobsang Rampa, I will ask you to tell us in your own words about this aura. Tell us as if we knew nothing whatever about the subject. Tell us so that we may understand and perhaps profit from your specialized experience. Well, that was quite a different matter. I liked Dr. Li, I liked the way he handled things. Dr. Li, I said, when I was born it was with the ability to see people as they really were. They have around them an aura which portrays every fluctuation of thought, every variation in health, in mental or in spiritual conditions. This aura is the light caused by the spirit within. For the first couple of years of my life I thought everyone saw as I did, but I soon learned that that was not so. Then, as you are aware, I entered a Lamasery at the age of 7 and underwent special training. In that Lamasery I was given a special operation to make me see with even greater clarity than that which I had seen before, but which also gave me additional powers. In the days before history was, I went on, man had a third eye. Through his own folly man lost the power to use that sight, and that was the purpose of my training at the Lamasery in Lhasa. I looked at them and saw that they were taking it in very well. Dr. Li, I went on, the human body is surrounded first of all by a bluish light, a light perhaps an inch, perhaps 2 inches thick. That follows and covers the whole of the physical body. It is what we call the etheric body and is the lowest of the bodies. It is the connection between the astral world and the physical. The intensity of the blue varies according to a person's health. Then beyond the body, beyond the etheric body too, there is the aura. It varies in size enormously depending on the state of evolution of the person concerned, depending also upon the standard of education of the person, and upon his thoughts. Your own aura is the length of a man away from you, I said to the principal, the aura of an evolved man. The human aura, whatever its size, is composed of swirling bands of colors, like clouds of colors drifting on the evening sky. They alter with a person's thoughts. There are zones on the body, special zones, which produce their own horizontal bands of color. Yesterday, I said, when I was working in the library I saw some pictures in a book on some Western religious belief. Here there were portrayed figures which had auras around their heads. Does this mean the people of the West whom I had thought inferior to us in development can see auras, while we of the East cannot? These pictures of the people of the West, I carried on, had auras only around their heads. But I can see not merely around the head, but around the whole body and around the hands, the fingers and the feet. It is a thing which I have always seen. The principal turned to Pochu. There, you see, this is the information which I had before. I knew that Rampa had this power. He used this power on behalf of the leaders of Tibet. That is why he is studying with us, so that, it is hoped, he can assist in the developing of a special device which will be of the greatest benefit to mankind as a whole in connection with the detection and cure of disease. What caused you to come here today? He asked. The lecturer was looking very thoughtful. He replied, "We were just commencing practical magnetism, and before I could show anything, as soon as I spoke about fields, this man said that he could see the fields around the magnet, which I knew to be utterly fantastic. So I invited him to demonstrate upon the blackboard. To my astonishment," he went on, "he was able to draw the field on the blackboard, and he was able also to draw the current field of a high-frequency transformer, but when it was switched off he saw nothing. I am sure it was a trick." He looked defiantly at the principal. "No," said Dr. Lee. "Indeed it was no trick. It was no trick at all. For this is known to me as the truth. Some years ago I met his guide, the Lama Minya Dondup, one of the cleverest men in Tibet, and he, out of the goodness of his heart, underwent certain tests, out of friendship for me, and he proved that he could do the same as can Lobsang Rampa. We were able, that is a special group of us, to make some serious researches into the matter. But, unfortunately, prejudice, conservatism, and jealousy prevented us from publishing our findings. It is a thing which I have regretted ever since." There was silence for a time. I thought how good it was of the principal to declare his faith in me. The lecturer was looking really gloomy, as if he had received an unexpected, unwelcome setback. He said, "If you have this power, why are you studying medicine?" I replied, "I want to study medicine and I want to study science as well, so that I may assist in the preparation of a device similar to that which I saw in the Changtang Highlands of Tibet." The principal broke in, "Yes, I know that you were one of the men who went on that expedition. I should like to know more about that device." "Some time ago," I said, "at the instigation of the Dalai Lama, a small party of us went upwards into a hidden valley in the mountain ranges in the Changtang Highlands. Here we found a city dating back to long before recorded history, a city of a bygone race, a city partly buried in the ice of a glacier, but where the glacier had melted in the hidden valley, where it was warm, the buildings and the devices contained in the buildings were intact. One such apparatus was a form of box into which one could look and see the human aura, and from that aura, from the colors, from the general appearance, they could deduce the state of health of a person. More, they could see if a person was likely to be afflicted in the flesh by any disease, because the probabilities showed in the same aura before it was manifest in the flesh. In the same way, the germs of coryza show in the aura long before they manifest in the flesh as a common cold. It is a far easier matter to cure a person when they are only just tinged with a complaint. The complaint, the disease, can then be eradicated before it obtains a hold." The principal nodded and said, "This is most interesting. Go on." I went on, "I visualize a modern version of that old apparatus. I would like to assist in the preparation of a similar device, so that even the most non-clairvoyant doctor or surgeon could look through this box and could see the aura of a person in color. He could also have a matching chart, and with that chart he would be able to know what was actually wrong with the person. He would be able to diagnose without any difficulty or inaccuracy at all." "But," said the lecturer, "you are too late. We have X-rays already." "X-rays?" said Dr. Lee. "Oh, my dear fellow, they are useless for a purpose such as this. They merely show gray shadows of the bones. Lobsang Rampa does not want to show the bones, he wants to show the life force of the body itself. I understand precisely what he means, and I am sure that the biggest difficulty with which he will be confronted will be prejudice and professional jealousy." He turned to me again, "But how could one help in mental complaints with such a device?" "Reverend Principal," I said, "if a person has split personality, the aura shows very clearly indeed, because it shows a dual aura, and I maintain that with suitable apparatus the two auras could be pushed into one, perhaps by high-frequency electricity. Now I am writing this in the West, and I am finding that there is much interest in these matters. Many medical men of the highest eminence have expressed interest, but invariably they say that I must not mention their name as it would prejudice their reputation. These further few remarks may be of interest. Have you ever seen power cables during a slight haze? If so, particularly in mountain areas, you will have seen a corona round the wires. That is, a faint light encircling the wires. If your sight is very good, you will have seen the light flicker, wane and grow, as the current coursing through the wires alters in polarity. That is much the same as the human aura. The old people, our great, great, great ancestors, evidently could see auras, or see halos, because they were able to paint them on pictures of saints. That surely cannot be ascribed by anyone as imagination, because if it was imagination only, why paint it on the head? Why paint it on the head where there actually is a light? Modern science has already measured the waves of a brain, measured the voltage of a human body. There is, in fact, one very famous hospital where research was undertaken years ago into X-rays. The researchers found that they were taking pictures of a human aura, but they did not understand what they were taking. Nor did they care, because they were trying to photograph bones, not colors on the outside of a body, and they looked upon this aura photograph as an unmitigated nuisance. Tragically, the whole of the matter relating to aura photography was shelved, while they progressed with X-rays, which, in my quite humble opinion, is the wrong way. I'm utterly confident that with a little research, doctors and surgeons could be provided with the most wonderful aid of all towards curing the sick. I visualize, as I did many years ago, a special apparatus which any doctor could carry with him in his pocket, and then he could produce it and view a patient through it in much the same way as one takes a piece of smoked glass to look at the sun. With this device he could see the patient's aura, and by the striations of color, or by irregularities in outline, he could see exactly what was wrong with the patient. That is not the most important thing. Because it does not help to merely know what is wrong with a person, one needs to know how to cure him, and this he could do so easily with the device I have in mind, particularly in the case of those with mental afflictions. Chapter 4 Flying. It was a warm, sultry evening, with hardly a breeze. The clouds above the cliff upon which we were walking were perhaps 200 feet above us, glowering cloud masses which reminded me of Tibet as they towered into fantastic shapes as imaginary mountain ranges. Huang and I had had a hard day in the dissecting rooms. Hard, because the cadavers there had been kept a long time, and the smell from them was just terrible. The smell of the decaying bodies, the smell of the antiseptic, and the other odors had really exhausted us. I wondered why I had ever had to come away from Tibet where the air was pure, and where men's thoughts were pure, too. After a time we had had enough of the dissecting rooms and we had washed and gone out to this clifftop. It was good, we thought, to walk in the evening and look upon nature. We looked upon other things as well because, by peering over the edge of the cliff, we could see the busy traffic on the river beneath. We could see the coolies loading ship, eternally carrying their heavy bales with a long bamboo pole across their shoulders, on each end of which would be loads of 90 pounds, heaped in panniers. The panniers weighed 5 pounds each, and so the coolie would be carrying not less than 190 pounds all day long. Life for them was hard. They worked until they died, and they died at quite a young age, worn out, human draft horses, treated worse than the beasts in the fields. And when they were worn out and felt dead, sometimes they ended up in our dissecting rooms to continue the work of good, and this time by providing material for embryo doctors and surgeons who would acquire skill with which to treat living bodies. We turned away from the edge of the cliff and faced into the very slight breeze which carried the sweet scent of the trees and the flowers. There was a slight grove of trees almost ahead, and we altered our steps slightly in order to go to them. A few yards from the cliff we stopped, aware of some strange sense of impending calamity, some sense of unease and tension, something inexplicable. We looked at each other questioningly, unable to decide what it was. Huang said, dubiously, "That cannot be thunder." "Of course not," I replied. "It is something very strange, something we know nothing about." We stood uncertainly, head on one side, listening. We looked about us, looked at the ground, at the trees, and then we looked at the clouds. It was from there that the noise was coming, a steady brum 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 getting louder and louder, harsher and harsher. As we gazed upwards we saw, through a hole in the cloud base, a dark winged shape flit across. It was gone into the opposite cloud almost before we were aware of its presence. "My!" I shouted. "One of the gods of the sky has come to take us off." There was nothing we could do. We just stood wondering what would happen next. The noise was thunderous, a noise of a sort that neither of us had heard before. Then, as we watched, a huge shape appeared, flinging wisps of clouds from it as if impatient of even the slight restraint of the clouds. It flashed out of the sky, skimmed straight over our heads, over the edge of the cliff with a sickening shriek, and with a buffet of tortured air. The noise ended and there was silence. We stood absolutely aghast, absolutely chilled, looking at each other. Then, upon a common impulse, we turned and ran toward the cliff edge to see what had happened to the thing from the sky, the thing which was so strange and so noisy. At the edge we flung ourselves prone and peered cautiously over at the sparkling river. There upon a sandy strip of ground was the strange, winged monster, now at rest. As we looked it coughed with a spurt of flame and a burst of black smoke. It made us jump and turn pale. But this was not the strangest thing. To our incredulous amazement and horror a piece opened in the side and two men got out. At that time I thought that was the most wonderful thing I had ever seen. But, we were wasting time up there. We sprang to our feet and raced for the path leading down. Down we sped through the street of steps, ignoring traffic, ignoring all courtesy, in our mad rush to get to the water's edge. Down by the side of the river we could have stamped our feet with frustrated anger. There was not a boat to be had, not a boatman, no one. They had all flocked across the water to be where we wanted to be. But, yes. There was a boat behind a boulder. We turned towards it with the intention of launching it and going across. But as we reached it we saw an old man coming down a steep path carrying nets. "Hey, father," Huang shouted, "take us across." "Well," the old man said, "I don't want to go. What's it worth to you?" He tossed his nets in the boat and leaned against the side, old battered pipe in his mouth. He crossed his legs and looked as if he could have stayed there all night, just chatting. We were in a frenzy of impatience. "Come, on. Old man, what's your charge?" The old man named a fantastic sum, a sum which would have bought his rotten old boat, we thought. But we were in a flurry of excitement, we would have given almost anything we had to get across to the other side. Huang bargained. I said, "Oh, don't let's waste time. Let's give him half what he asks." The old man jumped at it. It was about 10 times more than he had expected. He jumped at it, so we rushed for his boat. "Steady on, young gentleman, steady on. You'll wreck my boat," he said. "Oh, come on, grandpa," said Huang, "hurry up. The day is getting old." The old fellow leisurely got aboard, creaking with rheumatism, grunting. Slowly he picked up a pole, and pulled us out into the stream. We were fidgeting, trying mentally to move the boat more rapidly, but nothing would hurry the old man. In the center of the stream some eddy of current caught us and swung us around, then he got the boat on the right course again, and we went across to the far bank. To save time, as we were approaching, I counted out the money and pushed it at the old man. He was certainly quick to take it. Then, without waiting for the boat to touch, we jumped knee-deep in water and ran up the bank. Before us was that wonderful machine, that incredible machine, which had come from the sky, and which had brought men with it. We looked at it in awe, and were amazed at our own temerity in daring to approach like this. Other people were there, too, but they were staying a respectable distance away. We moved forward, we moved close to it, under it, feeling the rubber tires on the wheels, punching them. We moved to the stern and saw that here there was no wheel, but a bar of springy metal with a thing like a shoe at the end. "Ah," I said, "that'll be a skid to slow it down as it lands. We had a thing like that on my kites." Gingerly, half frightened, we fingered the side of the machine. We looked with incredulity as we found that it was a sort of fabric, painted in some way and stretched on a wooden frame. Now, this really was something. About halfway between the wings and the tail we touched a panel, and we nearly fainted with shock as it opened, and a man dropped lightly to the ground. "Well," he said, "you certainly seem to be very interested."
"We are indeed," I replied. "I've flown a thing like this, a silent one in Tibet."
He looked at me and his eyes went wide.
"Did you say in Tibet?" he asked.
"I did," I answered.
Huang broke in, "My friend is a living Buddha, a Lama, studying in Chongqing. He used to fly in man-lifting kites," he said.
The man from the air machine looked interested.
"That is fascinating," he said. "Will you come inside where we can sit down and talk?"
He turned and led the way in.
"Well," I thought, "I have had many experiences. If this man can trust himself inside the thing, so can I." So I entered as well, with Huang following my example. I had seen a thing larger than this in the highlands of Tibet, in which the gods of the sky had flown straight out of the world. But that had been different, not so frightening, because the machine that they had used had been silent, but this had roared and torn at the air, and shook. Inside there were seats, quite comfortable seats, too. We sat down.
"That man," he kept asking me questions about Tibet, questions which I thought absolutely stupid. Tibet was so commonplace, so ordinary, and here he was, in the most marvelous machine that ever had been, talking of Tibet. Eventually, after much time and with a great amount of trouble, we got some information out of him instead. This was a machine that they called an aeroplane, a device which had engines to throw it through the sky. It was the engines which made the noise, he said. This particular one was made by the Americans and it had been bought by a Chinese firm in Shanghai who had been thinking of starting an airline from Shanghai to Chongqing. The three men that we had seen were the pilot, a navigator, and engineer, on a trial flight. The pilot, the man to whom we were talking, said, "We are to interest notabilities and to give them a chance of flying so that they may approve of our venture." We nodded, thinking how marvelous it was, and how we wished that we were notabilities and would have a chance of flying. He went on, "You from Tibet, you are indeed a notability. Would you like to try this machine with us?" I said, "My goodness me, I would as quickly as you like." He motioned to Huang, and asked him to step outside, saying that he couldn't go.
"Oh no," I said, "oh, no. If one goes, the other goes." So Huang was allowed to stay. He did not thank me later. The two men who had got out before moved toward the plane and there were a lot of hand signals. They did something to the front, then there was a loud bam and they did something more. Suddenly there was a shocking noise, and terrible vibration. We clung on, thinking that there had been some accident, and we were being shaken to pieces.
"Hang on," said the man. We couldn't hang on more tightly, so it was quite superfluous of him.
"We are going to take off," he said. There was a simply appalling racket, jolts, bumps, and thuds, worse than the first time I went up in a man-lifting kite. This was far worse because in addition to the jolts, there was noise, abominable noise. There was a final thud, which nearly drove my head between my shoulders, and then a sensation as if someone were pressing me hard beneath and at the back. I managed to raise my head and look out of the window at the side. We were in the air, we were climbing. We saw the river lengthening into a silver thread, the two rivers joining together to make one. We saw the sampans and the junks as little toys like little chips of wood floating. Then we looked at Chongqing, at the streets, at the steep streets up which we had toiled so laboriously. From this height they looked level, but over the side of the cliff the terraced fields still clung precariously at the appalling steep slope. We saw the peasants toiling away, oblivious to us. Suddenly there was a whiteness, complete and utter obscurity, even the engine noises seemed muffled. We were in the clouds. A few minutes with streamers of cloud rushing by the windows, and the light became stronger. We emerged into the pale blue of the sky, flooded with the golden sunlight. As we looked down it was like gazing down on a frozen sea of snow, scintillatingly white, dazzling, eye-hurting with the intensity of the glare. We climbed and climbed, and I became aware that the man in charge of the machine was talking to me. "This is higher than you have been before," he said, "much higher than you have been before." "Not at all," I replied, "because when I started in a man lifting kite I was already 17,000 feet high." That surprised him. He turned to look out of the side window, the wing dipped, and we slid sideways in a screaming dive. Huang turned a pale green, a horrible color, and unmentionable things happened to him. He lurched out of his seat, and lay face down on the bottom of the plane. He was not a pleasant sight, but nothing pleasant was happening to him. I was always immune to air sickness, and I felt nothing at all except mild pleasure at the maneuvers. Not Huang, he was frightfully upset by it. By the time we landed he was just a quivering mass who occasionally emitted a painful groan. Huang was not a good airman. Before we landed the man shut off his engines and we drifted in the sky, gradually getting lower and lower. There was only the swish of the wind past our wings, and only the drumming of the fabric at the sides of the plane to tell us that we were in a man-made machine. Suddenly, as we were getting quite near the ground, the man switched on his engines again and we were once more deafened by the ear-shattering roar of many hundreds of horsepower. A circle, and we came into land. A violent bump, and a screech from the tail skid, and we clattered to a stop. Again the engines were switched off and the pilot and I rose to get out. Poor Huang, he was not ready to rise. We had to carry him out and lay him on the sand to recover. I am afraid that I was quite hard-hearted. Huang was lying face down in the yellow sand of the spit upon which we had landed in the middle of the mile-wide river. He was lying face down, making peculiar sounds and motions, and I was glad that he was not able to rise. Glad, because it gave me a good excuse to stop and talk with the man who had flown the machine. Talk we did. Unfortunately, he wanted to talk about Tibet. What was the country like for flying? Could planes land there? Could an army land there dropped by parachute? Well, I hadn't the vaguest idea what parachutes were, but I said no, to be on the safe side. We came to an arrangement. I told him about Tibet and he told me about aircraft. Then he said I would feel deeply honored if you would meet some of my friends who also are interested in the Tibetan mysteries. Well, what did I want to meet his friends for? I was just a student at the college, and I wanted to become a student of the air, and all this fellow was thinking of was the social side of things. In Tibet I had been one of the very few who had flown. I had flown high above the mountains in a man-lifting kite, but although the sensation had been wonderful, and the silence soothing, yet the kite had still been tethered to the earth. It could merely go up in the air, it could not fly over the land, wherever the pilot wanted to fly. It was tethered like the yak at pasture. I wanted to know more of this roaring machine that flew as I had dreamed of flying, that could fly anywhere, to any part of the world the pilot told me, and all he was bothering about was, talk about Tibet. For a time it seemed to be a deadlock. We sat on the sand facing each other with poor Huang groaning away to the side, and not receiving any sympathy from us. Eventually we came to an arrangement. I agreed to meet his friends and tell them a few things about Tibet and about the mysteries of Tibet. I agreed to give a few lectures about it. He, in his turn, would take me in the aeroplane again and explain how the thing worked. We walked around the machine first, he pointed out various things. The fins, the rudder, the elevators, all sorts of things. Then we got in and sat down, side by side, right in the front. In front of each of us now there was a kind of stick with half a wheel attached to it. The wheel could be rotated, left or right, while the whole stick could be pulled back or pushed forward. He explained to me how the pulling back would make a plane rise, and pushing forward would make it sink, and turning would also turn the machine. He pointed out the various knobs and switches. Then the engines were started and behind glass dials I saw quivering pointers which altered their position as the rates of the engines varied. We spent a long time, he did his part well, he explained everything. Then, with the engines stopped, we got out and he took off inspection covers and pointed out various details. Carburetors, sparking plugs, and many other things. That evening I met his friends as promised. They were, of course, Chinese. They were all connected with the army. One of them told me that he knew Chiang Kai-shek well, and, he said, the Generalissimo was trying to raise the nucleus of a technical army. Trying to raise the general standard of the services in the Chinese army.